Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by my co-host Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona.
How has your writing week been?
Fiona, I've been really looking forward to telling you about it. Because what I decided is that we all know, if you've been listening, I have a day job. And I struggle to find the writing time. And what I realized is that the rest of my team at work actually only start working at 9. Mm-hmm. And I'm normally in the office at least by 8. Mm-hmm. And I decided that what I was going to try doing is writing from 8 to 9. Mm-hmm. And that my rule is if I get there a bit later for whatever reason, I write until 9 with whatever time I've got left. And there are sometimes going to be times that I have an early morning meeting and I can't do it. But I'm going to aim at that 8 to 9. And it's been working really, really well. Mm-hmm. It's been a change of thought for me. Don't touch those emails first thing. Don't do that thing you were worried about yesterday afternoon. Write first. Right. Use the good energy for the passion. And it's worked so well that I yesterday had to drop my daughter at school very early. And then I had a meeting at the school an hour later. Mm-hmm. And I was going to sit in the car and read. And then I was like, you sit in the car and you write. Mm-hmm. And I sat in the car and I wrote so well. So I've had a really good writing week. What about you?
Well, the writing's been okay, but my thought processes are a bit stuck at the moment. I'm trying to come up with a decent plot for a book that I have in mind, which is a little bit literary, but I also want it to have commercial potential. And I realized that at this stage, I don't have a plot, I just have a premise. And this is something that I often tell, especially younger writers like teenagers when I do talks at schools. I say that as a youngster, you very often have a premise in mind. For example, there are three teenagers on a spaceship and the one's going to fall in love with the other and then the one's going to be jealous. That's not a plot. That's just a premise for the situation that you see your characters in. And very often those ideas run out of steam. You know, you might have one great scene in mind where you've described the spaceship and you've described the teenagers and you've described the dynamics between them, but that's it. That's where it ends. You've got nowhere to go with that. And I was wondering why this idea of mine hasn't yet found its legs.
I'm not going to let you carry on yet. Explain now, what would a plot be on that spaceship?
So on the spaceship, let's say they have a mission. They're there to mine an asteroid and send a precious metal back to their home planet, where everyone's going to die if they don't get the precious metal. And while they're there, the ship gets hit by a meteor and becomes damaged, and now they're stranded in space. And they get boarded by an alien who, you know, stuff needs to happen. There needs to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. There can't just be a situation that your characters are
in. And that excellent writing advice, complicate it. Think of a situation and complicate it and then complicate it again.
Yes, that's the thing. And at this stage, I've just got the premise. I've got an idea of a main character and a couple of secondary characters, and they are in a situation. Okay. And I was asking myself, now, why isn't this going anywhere? And you're right, I need to complicate it. Something needs to happen. We can't have books where nothing happens, certainly not ones written by me. So if by next week I've managed to make something actually happen, I'll let you know about it.
One of the podcasts I listened to this week really advises going for a walk in order to make that happen. And I have to say, I had a very successful walk the other day where I suddenly realized exactly how the next part of my book needs to start at the very least. And there is something in that going for a walk. So a long walk, Fiona, I'm prescribing a very long walk.
I will do it this afternoon and I'll let you know how it goes.
Fiona, what have you been reading or consuming or watching this week?
Well, that's actually interesting because the book I'm reading suffers from something which is preventing me from loving it. And I feel as though if I can identify what that something is, it would actually help me as a writer. Mm. And the book it's terribly popular. It's called The Dictionary of Lost Words by Pip Williams, who I believe is coming to the festivals in South Africa this year. So I hear. And I'm terribly excited about that. And this book is beloved. It really is. People loved it. I don't know if you've read it.
I think I've read it. You know my memory. It's the one where they're making the dictionary and they drop words on the floor.
That's it. That's it. Yes. And you know, it's got all the elements that I love.
Yes.
It's set in Oxford, which is a city that I love. It's about reclaiming the role of women in historical situations and acknowledging the role that women played in important events. In this case, they're putting together the Oxford English Dictionary. It was huge. It tackles all kinds of women's issues like the suffragettes, the women getting the vote, issues of abortion and reproductive rights. It's all stuff that's very close to my heart. And it's well written. It's beautifully executed. And the details are so fine and finely done. And I've been reading this book for weeks. My children keep looking at my Kindle and saying, "Are you still reading that?" And I'm like, "Yes, I'm still reading it." And I don't know why I've got so bogged down in it and why I don't look forward to going back to it. And yes, stuff is happening, but somehow for my 21st century tastes, it's not moving quite fast
enough. All premise and no plot.
There's a lot of premise, and we're kind of paddling around in this fairly interesting situation, but we aren't going places, you know. I don't know. I think it's a very personal thing because, as I say, this book is beloved. People have really loved it. I have heard that the next one, The Bookbinder of Jericho, is better, people
say. I have heard that too.
That people enjoy it more and they're like, okay, just get through this one and go read the next one. That one's really got something. I'm looking forward to it. I will definitely read the next one. I'm very much looking forward to the author coming to South Africa. But how about you? What have you been consuming?
So I don't have that problem. The book I am reading is full of plot. I am reading The Running Grave by Robert Galbraith.
And right.
Anyone who knows their reading world will know that Robert Galbraith is in fact J.K. Rowling.
Yes.
And this is an ongoing detective private investigator series where there is a overarching love story or not love story because they're not really managing to get it right. And in each book, they tackle quite an interesting topic. In this one, it is a cult.
And yeah, it's sort of ripped from the headlines type stuff.
Yes. So the last book, it was very interestingly written. It was set in an online gaming world.
Oh, right.
And there were parts of the book, it would be a very hard book to read on Kindle, The Ink Black Heart, because it's got the set out where you are in a chat room, in a gaming world. Very, very interesting. You know, I always struggle, and before we started recording, I said, have I spoken about the series before? I struggle with reading and loving Robert Galbraith and reading and loving J.K. Rowling because she has got some very controversial opinions about things. And a lot of people have stopped reading her because they find her opinions so unacceptable. And I have made the choice, rightly or wrongly, that the art is separate from the artist, and I'm continuing to read her. And really, they're fat books. So if you want a fat detective story with a good plot that keeps you reading, Robert Galbraith is something to think about.
Yeah, I agree. I've read them all up to and not including Ink Black Heart. And I've heard things that make me think maybe I'm going to skip that one and go straight to The Running Grave. But maybe I'll miss some crucial plot points between the main characters.
I missed a few in the middle there somewhere, and it didn't. I don't seem any the worse for it.
Well, a writer whose plot points you definitely don't want to miss is our guest today. Today's guest is Ron Irwin. Ron is the author of Flatwater Tuesday and My Side of the Ocean, which is recently out with Pan Macmillan. Ron is also a senior lecturer in media studies at UCT. He teaches in the UCT Creative Writing Masters program, and he was a teacher in the online Get Smarter Creative Writing course. Hi, Ron, and welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Ron, let's jump right in. How has your writing week been?
My writing week has been zero creative work because UCT is about to start again. And I have been helping students get their master's and PhDs ready for submission, which is next week, as well as preparing classes, which start on the 12th. So it's been wake up in the morning and work for UCT until I drop and then wake up and do it again. But I am thinking about a new novel. And I actually have some notes down, and I have actually three different projects I'm looking at. May the best project win. That's what we're thinking about right now. Which one is going to actually go the distance?
And Ron, when you are writing, when you are actively writing a novel, what does your writing day look like? What does your process look like?
I think the process is, I have a strange process, but I try to write every day. That's the first thing. And that's the oldest piece of advice you're ever going to get. Mm-hmm. If you do it every day, it's not as difficult. It's not as scary. You solve problems while you write. That's the first thing. You think you can solve problems by thinking about it, but it just doesn't work that way. As you write solutions, but more problems come up as you're putting words into the computer. And I think your brain starts to say, well, look, we've written 10,000 words. Now we're committed. Let's do another 5,000 and then see how far you get. But I try to write daily. I don't have a set writing time. I'd like to say I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and write, but I'm too tired. I have learned how to write when there's free time in between classes or in between meetings or whatever, or when everyone's asleep in the house, you know, and they're sleeping in, I'll get up and write then. And I have been watching it's kind of ridiculous, but these people who write novels on their mobile phone. And I have to say, I'm very envious about that. And they call it pantsing a novel. You can put the phone in your pants and you can pants it, which is, I suppose it's great if you're sitting in the subway sort of an hour and a half every day and you know, you need something to do. So that is my one thing. And the other rule that I adhere to is when I start getting stuck, I say to myself, and I started doing this when I did my PhD, well, just write the stupidest novel ever. Just write badly. Because if you write badly, well, at least for me, I find that my bad writing is pretty similar to my good writing, but that might be because my good writing is pretty bad. I don't know. And when I was doing my PhD, I really had no time to write. I was under a massive time constraint. So I just said, I'm going to write a really ridiculous chapter. And when I handed it in, I thought that the examiner is not going to accept some of the stuff that I've written. And in fact, they liked it. So I think that that's for me the best thing to do. And it's to write when you can. Write whatever you can, and remember it's a first draft and you're going to be editing it anyway. And a lot of times you'll say, well, I'll write along and I don't know exactly what the characters should say to each other or what they should do, so I just write they argue, and then I go back to the stuff that I want to write. I think that works. And I think one of the things when you're younger as a writer, like in your 20s, let's say, you have a lot of energy, which is great, but you have no patience, which is not great for this business. And as you get older, you have more patience. And patience is better than energy because 500-600 words a day is a lot if you're doing it all the time.
It's quite funny. As you said, patience is better than energy. Fiona and I both wrote that down. We write down the words of wisdom as they come, and we both considered that a great word of wisdom. Ron, tell us, you know, we've mentioned all the things you do. Tell us your superhero origin story. How did you come to be a writer? And taking us, as everyone can hear from your accent, if you can also take us on a journey across the sea, how you came to be in South Africa in Cape Town.
So I came to Cape Town in 92. I just graduated from university, and the plan was to work outside of Soweto, helping extremely poor students at a school called St. Barnabas. And I'd never been to South Africa, obviously. I didn't know much about the country. Back then, you couldn't just pick up a phone and look at pictures of Table Mountain and Joburg and all that. And since the country was still kind of on the naughty list, there wasn't a lot of information in the state. So I got off in Joburg. Really, I knew it would be a nice city. It was a much nicer city than I thought. I knew Soweto would be interesting. It was very interesting. And so I was supposed to be here for 15 months. And by the end of it, I'd come to Cape Town. I'd realized I want to stay in South Africa for, I suppose so many Americans and people from overseas say this. I thought I'll stay here for just another year. And another year comes and another year comes. I moved to Cape Town to do my master's degree with Jam Coetzee. I couldn't believe that he was here. I mean, I knew he was here, but I couldn't believe that he would take me as a student. That was an opportunity I couldn't lose. And so I went on as his supervisee. And I always wanted to do this. I always wanted to be a writer since I was a small, since I was a boy, since I learned people wrote books, I wanted to write books. But I was very stubborn and probably more stubborn than I would tell students to be, because I wanted to write the book that would become Flatwater Tuesday. So in between my master's work and in between traveling around and a lot of fun, I got the draft together for Flatwater Tuesday, and I found an agent in the States. And that was back in the days when you print out the manuscript on a dot matrix printer and go to the actual functional post office and send it airmail to New York. And I found an agent, and then we invented the fax. Remember the fax? And so I got a fax, and that was very modern. And she took me on, and she showed the book to a bunch of New York publishers way back in like 97, 98. And they all rejected it roundly. There were about 25 rejections. And the big objection was the book's about kids in high school, but it deals with adult themes. So how are we going to sell a book like that? And that was very discouraging. So I rewrote it, and we did it again in about year 2000, and we still got rejected because I really hadn't changed the main problem of how do you sell a book about high school students to adults. And so then I did a lot of agenting. I actually had an agency for a while. I did a lot of creative work as a documentary filmmaker. I did a whole lot of things thinking about the novel all the time, but I also had a lot of creative outputs, editing, teaching, creating video and doing all those good things. And then I got married and to a South African, by the way, who Fiona knows. And
I believe so.
Yeah, exactly. So that was, you know, but I never wanted to give up on that dream of that novel. And I taught a lot of creative writing, and because I was editing so much and editing kind of professionally, my wife was an editor, and I was selling people's fiction, I kind of thought, well, maybe that's my niche. I'm an editor and I'm a agent, and I, you know, maybe that I'm quite good at that. I have to say, and I think I am. People tell me I am. And I just stopped really writing the novel. I really stopped editing it. But what happened was, the years go by. Master's degree leads to another master's degree, and then a friend of mine, Stephen Watson, who you probably know of, died. Mm-hmm. And he'd been a massive supporter of me, and I was a big blow because he was only 57 years old. He's a professor at UCT. He had got me really a lot of work at UCT, which I badly needed at the time. And I just thought, you know, I do want to do this novel, and he would have wanted me to do it. And so I secretly started writing. I didn't tell anyone because my wife didn't want to hear. She said, listen, you and the rowing novel, forget the rowing novel. People don't like rowing. They don't like boarding school. It's not going to work. So I just deleted 95% of it and wrote the book altogether in about a year, I'd say. And then I took the novel and came home one day, printed out and presented it to my wife and said, my new novel. She said, oh, good. Tell me it's not about rowing. And I said, no, it's about, it's the same one, but I've actually rewritten it. And so she said, oh, and she read it. She said, no, this is way different, far more mature, far, far better. So yes, go ahead and send this to the publishers. First publisher saw it, bought it. And the rest is history, or sort of history. They sent me an agreement that's called, I forgot what it's called. The agreement was, don't show it to anybody else and we'll give you money, which is fine with me. And so it was interesting to have been rejected so many times. And then suddenly the first editor that sees it buys it. I thought that was quite an interesting situation to be in, but it was a nice situation to be in. And so far, the movie's in pre-production. The script's been made by Todd Karmanicki. It's been in pre-production for a long time. And we've come close, and then we run out of money, and then we come close again, and they run out of money. And so we'll see. The new Boys in the Boat movie that's out is engendering a lot of interest in rowing, so we're hoping that's going to work out.
Right.
So that's the superhero. That's the superhero origin story in a nutshell.
So I remember when Flatwater Tuesday was newly out and you were at a book festival and I saw you on a panel talking about it. And you said that when you did your kind of last rewrite of it, you decided to write a book that you, as a teacher, would give an A to instead of a D. And, you know, there's so many of us, there's so many young writers who have that heart novel, the one that's maybe based on an aspect of their own life, the one they've been burning to write, and they write it, and it's a bit of a first pancake and you know, has to end up in the bin. And then the second book they write is the one that succeeds and gets published. But you actually took the first pancake out of the bin, reworked it, and made it into something that an editor said yes to. So can you talk us through that process? How, because you can't just tell yourself, just stop writing a bad book, now write a good one. What did you actually do to write that book that you would have given an A to?
Okay, so the first thing that I would say to any student, I said to myself, and that's exactly what I think I remember saying that, is you need to be honest with yourself. You need to present yourself in an honest manner. And when you're writing about something that happened to you, okay, whether it's good or bad, but most people are writing novels about things that happened that were negative. Very few people sit down and say, wow, I had this really, really positive experience. I feel like writing a novel about it. It's usually there was a struggle that turned into a positive experience, or it was a struggle that wasn't positive. But when students go ahead and start writing, there's two major sins that they commit. The first is, because they are the protagonist is a wonderful person with zero faults and is good to everybody. And it's unfair what happens to that protagonist, because that's how we think of our lives. Mm-hmm. No matter who you are, you think you're the good guy in any story. And when you get dumped, or when you get someone divorces you, or someone steals your car, then you are the 100% the victim and the other person's 100% the bad guy. And so you have to look at yourself honestly at that level. You have to say, well, we have to create characters who have faults, who have problems, who have temper tantrums, who are forgetful, who are selfish, and then they're real. It's you know, I always call it the Bridget Jones Diary lesson, which is, here's this character who's, you know, she's a bit slovenly, and she sleeps around, and she eats too much, and she drinks too much, and we love her. That's why we like Bridget Jones. We don't want a goody two-shoes goody Bridget Jones. We want the naughty one who does all the stuff we're supposed to do. So that's number one. And then number two is, you have to look at what happened to you with a much more honest eye. You have to say, well, I'm going to go into the very difficult details. And some of the details are surprisingly difficult for people to write about. And, you know, when I say that, it's like saying, well, oh, I've had a terrible trauma and I don't want to write about it because it brings up so many terrible memories. But some people are just embarrassed to write about the things they actually said in the heat of an argument. Or they did something that is really, from the point of view of a reader, is not really that dramatic. It's not really that bad. But because it's our story, because it's embarrassing, we don't want to say it. We don't want to go and say, well, you know, and you have to go there. Embarrassment and shame, the writer's best friends. Nobody in exclusive books right now wants to write about a book, right? Wants to read a book about somebody who's completely happy and proud of themselves. I always think of it this way. Say you go out to lunch with somebody and someone says, oh, I have something to tell you. I'm so proud of my son. Here's what he did. And you think, oh God, here it comes. He got six distinctions on the matric, and then they made him captain of the cricket team. And you're like, oh, that's so wonderful for your son. Oh, and my husband got a promotion, and I lost 5 kgs. And you're like, great. When is this lunch going to be over? What you want to hear is, listen, dude, I got to tell you something. This is so bad. This is so, and what? I'm so ashamed of what I did. What? Like, listen, tell anyone. you tell anyone, I'll never speak to you again. What I did last night was so bad. And everyone's like, what did you do? And, you know, I pulled out my phone and I called, bah, 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 you know, the ex-girlfriend or the ex-boyfriend, or I bought the crack, or I did whatever, you know, and that's funny. And that's what we want to hear. And right. And most people in who take fiction courses, they're A students. They're people who are really smart. And so they think of themselves as perfect. They've always been given A pluses in school. And you have to say, I would rather have someone who is absolutely honest in the story and is able to look at themselves, if they're writing about them, something that happened to themselves or it's based upon their lives, in an honest manner, than someone who's going to, you know, not do that, be far too perfect. You know, as writers, we start to do that instinctively, but you forget that you're doing it. I remember one time I needed money, and I'd read that. Remember Barry Ronger? Barry Ronger wrote Mills and Boone's romances. That was the big rumor. So I thought to myself, well, if he can do it, I can do it. So I went online and I ordered the Mills and Boone romance kit. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's hilarious. It's great. And the idea was they'll give you sort of $10,000 or like $4,000 for a book. They give you the outline. And of course, there's no way I could ever do this. But you know, you figure, why not? 4,000 bucks is 4,000 bucks. And you read the outline and it says, okay, here's your book, writer. The heroine is Gail Snickers. And Gail Snickers is pretty, but not too pretty. And she has faults, but nothing gross. So a mole she doesn't like, okay, but she can't be missing an arm. And it's like, this is terrible. And I mean, this is the instructions they give you. So it's like, and give her something she's embarrassed about, it, but it can't be awful. It can be, you know, she's embarrassed about the fact she likes to be spanked, but it can't be she's embarrassed about the fact she burned her boss's car in the parking lot. And so, you know, I thought that was a very good lesson to say to writers, look at the faults of your friend. Look at the shame is your friend. Look at the embarrassment is your friend. And when people have to get through their faults and their embarrassment and their shame, then you get a better book, essentially. You really do. And I've had students, particularly at UCT, particularly adult students, and now, of course, with the political comment being what it is, you have to phrase that very carefully. I mean, you can't, you know, they go running to Twitter and say, my horrible creative writing teacher just told me to write about shame. And I know I feel ashamed and I'm traumatized. You can't do that. But adult students will often just not point blank, not do it. I mean, it's very, very difficult. But when they do it, then they really do it because they have real things to be embarrassed and shamed about because they're older. They've actually gone through some pretty bad things. And that's what we want to hear about.
There's so many questions out of that. I don't even know where to start with everything that's going on in my head. I want to know, did you try and write the Mills and Boone? Because I once did a Mills and Boone course. And I did write my Mills and Boone.
I couldn't.
I had a fantasy.
I'm sure you did. Did you get it published?
I know. I had a fantasy that I was going to fund my other writing by writing Mills and Boone.
Yeah, that's what you think, right?
I wrote it with too little respect for the reader. In retrospect, I can see that I didn't respect my reader, so I wrote a load of rubbish and I rightfully got rejected.
Right. I had a friend who she's published 4 novels and they're all, you know, they've all been in, you know, reviewed in the New York Times and they're, you know, serious novels. And so they take place in New York. But she wrote, when she was in her 20s, 12 Saddle Club books. And Saddle Club books are books about girl goes off, she's 15 or 16 or 15 years old, goes off to saddle riding or riding camp and falls in love with a groom type of thing. And she would get paid and she could turn them around really quickly, but she grew up going and riding horses. And there was a little bit of a buy-in, she told me. She said, you have to buy into it. Mm-hmm. You have to really at one level like this stuff. And if you don't, you're not going to be able to write it. Mm-hmm. And she got to the point where they were giving her quite a lot of money and she could knock one off in less than a month. And so, I mean, I thought that was pretty good advice. You have to buy in to what you're writing as to be a novelist. Most people do. I mean, I suppose there are novelists out there who think it's all just they're writing twaddle every day and they don't care. But I think even when you're writing stuff that is perfect, steamy genre fiction, there's people who are just good at it and they do buy into it. They may deny it, but they do. And they have a skill, and that's great.
Ron, I'm so interested to hear that your wife said that, you know, not boarding school and not rowing, because I actually think those are two of the magical elements of that book. The fact that it's a boarding school story and the fact that it's set on the water, the rowing, the epic struggles, the God fall, etc. Why do boarding schools have that mystique? What is it about children, I think, being maybe removed from their families and being put together that creates such great coming of age novels? And rowing itself, it is an sort of archetypal struggle.
Yeah. And I'm going to add to that, I was surprised that you said that you were rejected on the boarding school thing, because when I started out, I was like, ooh, boarding school novel, because for me it's a genre that I like. I almost immediately go into my Donna Tartt Secret History feeling. I get that, ooh, it's a boarding school thing. If you can talk about all of that.
So J.D. Salinger, Donna Tartt, I mean, novels about boarding school go all the way back to English novels, and they're basically a genre in and of themselves. I mean, even Woodhouse and stuff like that. But there were a whole bunch of popular, there's plenty of novels. I mean, the Good Dead Poets Society, in terms of movies and so forth. And now there's The Holdovers, which is a great film. So I didn't think it was such a bad idea. In fact, I thought it was a very good idea. And the editors in New York had kind of thought that, well, it's too rarefied, but I didn't think so at all. And I still don't think so. Looking how well The Holdovers is doing is a great example. As you say, you have to stick to your guns. You'll get somebody who will read the book and say, oh, well, this isn't going to appeal to the average reader because it's so elite, but that's the actual attraction. People are interested in the lives of the elite. They're interested in what happens in these places. And it's also a canned drama. There's no way you could take 600 people under the age of 18 and put them in a dorm and expect there not to be drama. Mm-hmm. And there is drama. And we're used to that drama. We're also really interested in, you know, the teaching. I had a lot more teaching scenes, which I cut because I made more rowing scenes. Rowing is a separate discussion. We'll get to that in a second. But I was absolutely dead set on having it. Even while I was experiencing it as a teenager, I thought, I got to write a book about this. No one would believe what I'm going through. And what I actually wrote was actually tame compared to what I experienced in boarding school, because people would not believe, literally a reasonable reader would not believe what we did in boarding school, the things that we got into. I mean, we read a book one time. We read that there were rattlesnakes out in the mountains near the school. So we went in and we to Hartford and bought a rattlesnake catching kit and a big tank and went looking for these huge snakes. And we found them and kept them in the science building until one of the teachers discovered that we were doing this and made us get rid of them. I mean, things like that. I mean, or jumping off the bridges and the ridiculous things that we would do, hanging people out the window. They did it a lot. And you could have died 10,000 times over. But the point to me was, boarding school, when I got there, was in many ways far different than I thought it would be. I knew it would be elite. I knew it would be beautiful. I knew it would be a good education. I got that. And it was. But it was far more brutal than I was expecting. I remember thinking, I'm very happy I can row, because if you can row, you are immediately part of the coolest club on campus. And so nobody, and also if you're sort of 6 foot two at the age of 17, that helps. But I felt very sorry for kids who came from kind of other countries or, you know, and they were just math prodigies or something. Their lives, they lived in fear. And now I think a lot of that's over now, I must say. I think that the 1980s is a lot different than what happens now, or so I'm told. But then again, teenage boys don't change very much. And, you know, The Lord of the Flies is a popular book for a reason. Another school book, by the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have kids, Fiona has kids, and you hear what it goes on at private schools in Cape Town. And it sounds very familiar to me. And I wanted to write about it. And I wanted to write about it because I thought there was also a kind of nobility about it. And there was an experience I wanted to get down on paper. And then superimposed on that was rowing. And funny enough, Rowing goes in and out of fashion, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is filming things on the water is very difficult. But what got my book published, I was told, was that if you remember the movie The Social Network.
Yeah.
And in The Social Network, it's about the founding of Facebook. But there's two guys, the Winklevoss twins, in our sport, they're very well known. And they had created the rudimentary form of Facebook, and then Zuckerberg stole it from them. And then they've complained about it ever since, even though they got $60 million out of the deal. And they were already incredibly rich, but that's a different story. But in the Social Network, there's a scene when the Winklevoss twins go to Henley, and they filmed the race at Henley. And that one, and it's maybe 20 seconds long, but that small scene made people so interested in rowing that they decided to publish my book. So I owe something to Mark Zuckerberg, I suppose. Thanks, Mark.
I'm sure.
And the nice thing about rowing as well is that it's very easy to understand who wins. If you have to worry about football, it's very complicated. You know, but golf even is complicated. Rowing is, here's a boat, there's another boat, get across the line. We understand that. And so I didn't want to avoid writing about it. Well, that was what the book was about.
I just want to say, I'm sure the book would have been published anyway. I think the book has enough strength that you didn't need The Social Network rowing in order to get published.
You never know. That's what they tell you. You never know if it's going to be fashionable. You know, you just have no idea, you know. And it is interesting. And of course, we're all, as novelists, and you, I'm sure you're the same, and we could discuss it. Is you worry about trends. You worry about, are you on trend? You know, what is the new thing that publishers are looking for? And I do tell students, remember, the trend right now might not be the trend in 2 years when you're finished with that novel. Mm-hmm. And there's certain trends that are never going to go out of style. And, you know, there's a reason why romance novels are 75% of the market. And there's a reason why certain chains of books just keep selling. But yes, I think writing to the trend is not a very good idea for most writers.
Ron, you've had an experience that neither Gail nor I has had, which is to have a book actively in development, in film development in Hollywood for a number of years. Can you talk us through that process, the highs, the lows, the disappointments, the triumphs? You know, it's a long thing. We know it's difficult, but what has that been like?
It is. So you learn a lot about how Hollywood works when your novel is in development. And everything I learned, I did not expect. And everything I continue to learn, I don't expect. It is, although I will say, publishing is a very irrational business as well, but the movies make publishing look like selling tuna fish. and so the rights to make the novel, to make the film, you have a novel, somebody buys the right to make the idea of your novel. You have to sell that to somebody. I've sold it to very nice guys. It just so happens the people I sold it to went to boarding school with me and were on that team. And they've made 1883, they've made Captain, they've made Marvel movies, they've made an assortment of films. It's Winter Brothers Entertainment. And I can remember when one of the brothers was streaming homesick for his mom, and now he's a big wheel in Hollywood. But so they take the idea, they take the rights to make the film, and they give you some money, and then they disappear. But what they need to do, which was, I did not know this, is if you want your film to get made, you need to obviously have a script. And if the script's made by a named script writer, you are in much better shape. So my script is written by Todd Kamernicki. He was part of the producers of the movie Elf, but he also wrote the script for Sully and the script for God Spy and a number of other films. And he's become quite a big name. So he wrote the script and sent it to me after we met in New York, which is, he was a fun person. We went to the school and I brought him around and I brought him to the school reunion. And so I show up with the script writer of my novel based on the school. And I was very nervous about bringing this stranger into the boarding school scene. And of course, everyone now is an adult, but they're not really adults. And so what we did was we said, Todd was an exchange student. But every time people said, who's this guy with you? I'd say, don't you remember Todd? He was an exchange student our junior year. And they'd say, where was he from? I said, well, he was from Hungary. But he's fine. You know, he's learned English really well. And he played this up. He said, I love Kent. You don't remember me? No. So everyone kind of adopted him. They thought he was cool. And then someone let the secret slip that he's writing a script about Kent. And then everyone thought that was very funny. And but what I noticed about him, he knew nothing about rowing. We took him out in a boat. But he went to the coach and he went to everyone involved in rowing, school worship rowing. And I said, I keep talking to me about what people say, about the terms, the terminology, slang, the insults, the things that are good, the things that are bad. And he just listened, took notes. And the next day, we stayed in the dorms. The next day, he left and he produced the script in a few months. And he sent it to me. And I was happy with the script. I'm very happy with the script. It's a beautiful script, except it has excised the adult romance. It's completely about the rowing race that is the focus of my novel.
Right.
But the focus, my novel is the rowing race, but it's also about a love story that the adult person 15 years later is going through. And he just got rid of that. He just made it about the race. But I can see why, because it's far more visual, because there's romance in the boat, because the coxswain is a woman and the guys fight over her, and as they did in real life. And so he did change it. And then the movie happened. And this is the second thing I did not understand until I went through it. That script gets sent to the actors, okay? And if a big actor says, I've read the script and I want to be involved, then that attracts the money, right? And so I used to think it's sort of the way you see it in The Godfather. There's like the studio decides we're going to make this picture, you know, go get me an actor, bring me Marilyn Monroe. No, it's not the way it works at all. It's the exact opposite. You write the book, they write the script, the script goes to the actor sits by his pool or wherever, reads it and says, or she, I'll be in the script if you get the money. If the actor's big enough, they get the money. And so we've gotten all the way down the road with actors being very kind and wanting to be part of it. But unfortunately, not enough money comes in at the right time, or it does come and the director they had lined up has to go do something else and then the money falls apart and so on and so forth. It's like bringing Cinderella to the ball. You need to get everything at once for the film to fall into place. Okay, look, if you're J.K. Rowling, you've written a massive bestseller, then things that pushes things further because there's a built-in audience. But otherwise, you need to have it all happen. The stars have to align all at once. So now another production company's gotten involved, and they've bought into the rights, and they're very aggressive about doing it. These guys have created, funny enough, they just created the latest Halloween movie, and a movie called The Black Phone, and their specialty seems to be in Wind River, cop movies and horror movies. So they're doing the same thing. And so it's a roller coaster ride. It's an emotional roller coaster ride, because suddenly after not hearing from them for 2 months, you'll get an email and it'll say, great news. Such and such an actor said yes. And you'll say, oh, they can't say no. And then they go to get the money and they go to the people and there's all kinds of happiness. Such and such an actor just got seconded to another film and is now under contract. We can't use that actor anymore. Oh, just square one. But it is fun. And the nice part about it is they have to keep paying you every year for the rights to do this. And so as long as they do that, you have a warm, fuzzy feeling about Hollywood. In fact, Jackie, my wife, said, I would prefer that than you getting the movie made. You know, and I want the movie made, obviously. But yearly payment for 10 years is great. It's been no problem, you know. And that's how I put my kids through school. And so I've made more money, and I don't want to sound crass, off a movie that was never made than the book. So that's the way the business works. Which is strange. It's not like I've made tons of money. I'm not trying to suggest that I'm sitting here in my Ferrari talking to you. I'm not. But it's been very, 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 very affirming.
We strongly understand that the problem is that one makes so little money from the book that anything is comparatively a huge amount of money.
I love when Winston say, "I'm just going to write this novel for the money." I'm only in it for the money. Okay, good.
I want to take a step back. You talked about that you are thinking about various projects and you're thinking about which one is the idea that has the legs to run. And I want you to talk us through like what that looks like. And I'm thinking of kind of the new writer who's trying to do that process of thinking. I just listened to a podcast with this woman's process is that she thinks about a book for 9 months. She doesn't allow herself to write a word until 9 months of thinking have passed. So I just want you to talk through what does it look like for you, that thinking process?
Well, I think that's a very good idea if you have the time to just take 9 months to see if you still love the idea, because then you're going to be with that idea for a long time. The process for me starts with a character. It should always start with a character. You have to start with a character who really is very, very vivid in your mind, someone you feel you know and you can convince a reader that you know, a character with details, a character with a past, a character who's complex, a character who's going to keep the reader's attention over 300 pages. And so the characters come to me, and it's funny. I always feel it's sort of like being haunted because they come to me, but they don't say anything. I can imagine the character. It takes a long time for them to speak to me, but I can imagine what they look like and what they've done. And if the character keeps coming back, then you start thinking, well, what's this character's story? Why is this character bothering me? What's going on? And the characters, I don't know where the characters come from. They come from real life, but they also come from other books that you've read. They've come from movies that really stayed with you. They've come from situations you've heard about. Sometimes I'll hear a story at dinner, and it'll just set me off, and I'll think, that would make an interesting novel. When you have that character in mind, and you've written that person down, and you've made a few pretend scenes so you can imagine what that person would say and how they would speak, then you start to say, are there other characters that would work with this main character I've thought of? The plot, the story, all that comes second. That's all. That is the last consideration for me, at least the way I do it. And if you have those, and if the character goes the distance, and you start writing about that character and making scenes with that character in it, and you want to read more about that character and you want to discover more about that character, then that starts to tell you this is a book that might be a good one for you to write. And it's interesting, and I'd like to hear your points of view, because sometimes you feel very alone as a writer. Sometimes you think, well, I'm going to be writing a story that I've never written before and that I don't know much about this genre. Or I don't know much about this milieu, but I really want to write it anyway. And I don't know why. And I think that you just have to take that leap. If the character and the story has stayed with you for so long and you know you can write about that person convincingly. And the second thing is, or whatever, mostly the fourth thing, is don't tell anyone about it. Don't tell your husband or your wife or your significant other or your dog or your kids or your friend or the bartender, nobody. Because people are not equipped to give you the kind of advice and support that you need. What they'll do is they'll either really like it, which is not helpful, or they'll say something slightly critical and it'll put you off your oats. Then you don't want to do it anymore. You know, the minute you're in such an emotional moment that if somebody says something negative, it just makes you feel negative about the entire project. It's sort of like it's sort of like a love affair. You meet somebody on the bus and you just feel a spark. And you go home and you tell somebody about it and say, well, you can't go out with somebody off the bus, you know. And then that's it. Then it's over, you know. And I think that it's keeping it to yourself, writing it, building it, seeing if you like it. And then if you can stick with it, then that's going to be the one that really does go the distance. And then the third thing is, don't listen to the trends, because it's scary. You go online and you'll say, oh, well, white males, who wants to hear from them anymore? You know, they might as well stop writing. I've read about 7 articles like that. In fact, white males, their very existence is wrong and they shouldn't be writing anything anymore. And we've heard enough of them. Well, I can't change what I am. I just can't. And I see other white males doing pretty well. So, you know, I'm not, but it does put you, sometimes you think, well, maybe they're right. You know, it's oppressive for me to be writing, but what am I supposed to do? Not write? I can't not write. I have to write. But and so when you read those things, you have to take it all with a grain of salt. Or they'll say, you know, there's certain voices or certain stories that have to be written now, and other stories are never going to work. That's in 2 years, I can guarantee you they'll have changed their tune. There'll be something that will change that entire thing. And pretty much every big novel that I can think of off the top of my head has bucked a trend, has gone and been, you know, J.K. Rowling. That is a great example of a bumblebee of a novel. That who would have thought a wizard school novel aimed at children but read by adults is going to do so well when there's so much fantasy out there? So much. And that's the one. That's the one that does it. I mean, and I'm reading a bunch of books right now, and as I read them, I keep thinking to myself, not one of them. If someone came to me with the idea in my office and shut the door and said in a trembling voice, "Ron, do you think I should write this book?" I'd say, "You're really shooting in the dark here." You know, I'll give you an example. All right, I actually have a list here, if I may. So I just finished The Pole by John Cuzzia. I don't know if you've read that yet. The Pole and Other Stories.
Nope.
Okay, so it's about a 75-year-old pianist who has an affair with a 40-year-old woman. And he kind of seduces her against her will. Does that sound like that's going to work? I wouldn't say that's going to, but it's written by John Cuzzia. Mm. And it's brilliant. And it's actually the best writing he's done in probably 20 years. And he's 84 years old, by the way. He's going to be 84 this year. A Little Life. Have you read A Little Life yet?
Yeah.
So
yes, I say with a deeply traumatized face.
Wow. I mean, I would say this book would get published. It'd be an important book. I would be so surprised if I thought this book would be the bestseller, the massive bestseller that it became. I read a novel recently which won a bunch of prizes called On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. And that was a really interesting novel and an interesting voice, but I wouldn't have thought that's going to do so well. And Yellowface, of course, is killing it. And Yellowface is another one. Yellowface is probably a voice that people do want to hear. Okay. So I will say that is a voice that seems to be very much on point in what publishers are looking for now. And it is a good novel.
It's interesting what you say about being secretive, because Fiona and I are both quite secretive writers, and I think we find that most people aren't. So it's quite nice to hear that there are other secretive writers out there.
I think it's very important. I really do. I do.
Ron, with Flatwater Tuesday, you had the male protagonist who was based on, you know, aspects of your own experience. And then in My Side of the Ocean, you have the female protagonist, Stella. Was that an easy switch to make? Did she always come to you as a female character? How did that sort of character development process happen?
So the novel came to me as an idea. I'd been to Bachoven, and actually a friend of mine had a place in Llandudno with the pool carved into the rock. And I had this idea of a man standing in front of a pool with all the furniture, the patio furniture thrown into it. Mm-hmm. And there he was in this beautiful ocean, and he's throwing all the furniture there, and he has a drink in his hand. And I thought, what's going on with this novel? And I really couldn't get out of my mind. I love the idea of a beach house. I love the idea of it being by the sea. I love the idea of being an American. I really felt and still feel that this is a great place to set a novel, and Americans are curious about it. It's the number one tourist destination and so forth. And so I started writing it, and I realized it's about an older man and a younger woman. The problem became I couldn't make the man not seem creepy.
Right.
There's no
right.
nice way for me, and maybe other people can do it. I don't think Nabokov did it, but I think it's very difficult to write a scene when a man's 20 years older than, say, a student or whatever, a woman, and he's trying to seduce her, they're flirting with each other, whatever, without it looking a little bit icky on the page. I just couldn't do it. And, you know, I have two daughters, and I kept thinking, I don't want to write a novel where I feel gross the entire time. So I thought, but, and this is the thing that surprised me, there's something okay about it if it's the woman who's older. If the woman's older hitting on a 25-year-old man, somehow that's fine. I don't know why, but it seemed fine. And so I started writing about Stella, and then it seemed, you know, people say, well, how can you write from a woman's point of view? I probably know more women than most women, you know, and I've certainly women have been in my life my whole life, and I've, you know, if you live with a woman, you start to get a feel for what they care about and so forth. My wife actually thinks I'm not, that Stella's a very thoughtless, hard person and kind of masculine, maybe. But so it began to be, I was so surprised at finding this kind of, that's what the novel has to be. She has an affair with a younger man. And then I was writing the book. I got about, I don't know, halfway into it. And I rewatched an old movie with Richard Gere and Diane Lane. I don't know if you remember it. I think it's called Unfaithful. And Diane Lane was given, she has an affair on her husband. Richard Gere is the husband, and she has an affair with this younger guy in this beautiful apartment. And there's a scene when she's left the guy, and she's on the train going out to the suburbs back to her husband. And she's just sitting there thinking about what she's just done with this younger guy and kind of luxuriating it, but also feeling bad about it. And she does, there's no dialogue. There's nothing. It's just focused on her kind of shivering and just shifting in her seat as she thinks about it. And I thought that is such a good, that was like a signal to me, right? Put that into the novel that you're writing. I thought it was such a good scene. And I always think Diane Lane should have got more prizes in for acting with Diaz, although she's a big actress. And the novel came, was fairly easy to write. In fact, writing about the male character was harder for me. Very, very difficult. Because I had to make him interesting, but I had to make him not take the stage from the main character.
I'm interested in how you, when you're talking about the writing, it's clear we often ask people if they're plotters or if they're pantsers. So do you sit down and plot or do you write by the seat of your pants? And you seem to be a pantser in that sense, not the sense of writing on your cell phone. But can you talk us through it a bit? Because how does one sit down with a very, with a character or a glimmer of a feeling and an idea and a vision of a pool full of patio furniture? And then how do you write? Because I'm a plotter, so I need to know how to pants.
Well, to me, there's the way you turn a character into a plot is the first order of business is you think, what did the character want? What does the character really desire, really crave, really need? Okay, what is, if the character, so many times students will say, yeah, my characters just sort of live in the world, man. They don't want anything. Wanting's bad. And you'll say, no, everybody wants something. Kurt Vonnegut once said, if your characters don't want something, make them want a glass of water. Everybody has to drink water. Okay. Make them want what everybody has things they want and need and crave and desire. Nobody, you might have given up on those. You might have given up on them. And now, and you think you're never going to get them, or you're never going to attain them, or never going to be them. But we all have them. So if I have something I really want, then you think about a catalyst. And the catalyst to me is, well, I want a Porsche. I want a Porsche right now. I would take a 911. If you gave me a 911, I would take it. I would not feel bad about it. I drive it very badly because my vision's bad and so forth. I want a Porsche, but I don't need a Porsche. I don't need a Porsche. I'm happy with my Hyundai. I'll live with it, okay? But if I suddenly wanted it and needed it, what would make it so I would do something that would take me out of the so-called comfort zone, or as they, you know, in narratology, they call it stasis. That you know, you think of James Bond. You know, he's sitting there drinking champagne and smoking cigarettes until he's called to action. You know, by Q, and or by M, and what would make the character get out of stasis and go for it? Go for what they want. What is the thing propelling them forward? In most novels, most fiction that fails or is difficult for students is they don't have that thing propelling them. the character sort of wants something, but the minute there's a problem or there's a challenge or whatever, they don't know what to do. And that's because that's kind of how we are in real life. We want stuff, but we're very reasonable what we want. You know, there's never been, you know, a time in many people's lives they're like, I'm going to be unreasonable about something and I'm going to go get it. And I don't care what gets in front of me. And that's what makes a good novel. If you think about it, people say, oh, yeah, well, what about Holden Caulfield? He wants to get home. That's the oldest plot in the book, The Odyssey. I need to get home. And that's what the Catcher in the Rye is, The Odyssey. In a love affair, and again, love affairs feature in, you know, 75% of novels out there. If you want somebody, you're willing to do something, to go to great lengths to be with them, not just give up, not just feel intimidated, not just go home and do nothing. That's what we're looking for. And that seems to drive the plot very nicely.
It's interesting to me that you saw Stella, that the affair came to your mind first. Because in that book, I very much saw it as she's cheating on America with South Africa. She's cheating on New York with Cape Town. And that's where her true desire and her true love resides. And that the crisis at the beginning of the book, the encounter with the shark, propels her to realize what she really wants. So I'm interested to know, did you also see it like that? And were your own desires sort of reflected in that plot?
I think with Stella, I really wanted to explore the idea. I read an article a long time ago about infidelity. You know, as I was writing it, I knew she was going to be cheating on her husband. And infidelity is interesting because in the movies it's presented that the person you're going to cheat with is so attractive, they're irresistible. Okay, so that the simple-minded plot is, you know, you're sitting in your office and your younger coworker is just so hot that you can't help yourself and you do something stupid. But that's not actually what happens in real life. What happens in real life is as you get into a committed relationship, you're shutting the doors on the person you could have been if you weren't in that relationship. So that when you get married, there's even that line, you're forsaking all others. And that word forsaking is a really, really rough word. It's saying, I'm leaving you guys behind, and this is the person I'm going to be with. And that's nice and romantic, but it's a little bleak. Because the longer you're married, the longer you're with somebody, even if the person's wealthy, and of course, Jackie, my great editor, she's always trying to find holes that might hurt me. She'll say, what woman would leave such a nice, rich guy? I mean, come on, Ron. That's sad. So I went online. I spoke to a lot of women about it, and half of them were like, would leave my – totally believable to me. Absolutely believable. And then and two of them said, I was on an online forum, said, I did it. I definitely left a rich husband. Rich husbands get left on the side of the road every day of the week. No questions about it. Doesn't matter how nice they are. They get
and
left
he's not that
all the
nice.
Time by women.
He's a bit obnoxious.
And he's not that nice. He's a bit obnoxious. And Stella wants to see who she could have been, who she left behind. She feels she's sort of sold out. And even though she has a nice life and a nice career, she sold out on the kind of grungy, tough person that she was turning into to lead a softer life. And then when she met her husband, she really was, you know, able to do whatever she wanted. And what she wanted, and the person she could have been had she not had that, taken that softer option, is something that you always worry about and think about. And he represents that. The man that she cheats on him with represents that grungy, harder, hippie life. But she also realizes that she probably couldn't be his wife. She couldn't live with him forever. But it does mean that she can leave him and go live the life that she envisioned in Cape Town, because Cape Town's a very creative place. Cape Town's a place that's a great place for creative people, I find. And of course, the lovely thing about a novel is that you don't have to think too deeply about the mechanics of it all. It's like, you know, so, you left your millionaire husband and he's now going to take the money and you're a painter, but you still get to live in Bakoven and have an income that allows you to walk on the beach and do it. Yes, that's called fiction. And that works beautifully in fiction, you know, and we're just going to do it that way. And, you know, maybe she got a very good agreement in the divorce. And I leave it open. Maybe she'll go back to the husband. I don't know. I mean, 9 times out of 10, we've all had this conversation over coffee. Why would she leave him for that guy? Or why would she leave? Why would he leave that wonderful wife for that woman? I mean, that's ridiculous. You've heard that gossipy conversation, but a novelist is a gossip. And then you ask, well, why? What exactly made you do it? And you, as a novelist, you're asking hard questions of people. I mean, I've sat up and really, I've asked probably prying questions because I'm very curious. You know, you're getting divorced or you're cheating on your wife, man. Nobody knows why. What are you getting? And some of the people can't articulate, but then they start to be able to articulate. They start to be able to say, well, this is what's happening for me. And that's what goes into the novel. And, of course, that's all stuff that people don't like to talk about and think about, but that's fiction. That's plot.
Yeah, I've been at parties where I've been talking to people, and after a while they say to me, I feel like I'm being interviewed. And I'm like, well, yes, you are. I'm interviewing you to be a character in my book.
Yes, James Thurber's wife used to say to him, Thurber, stop writing. She had parties. Stop writing. Stop writing and go to the party. Stop writing. But you can't help it.
Well, Ron, we are fascinated to hear now, what are you watching or reading or listening to that's made an impression on you? Because I have a feeling it would be something very interesting.
Well, you know, as far as what I'm watching, I just finished Slow Horses, which I thought was very, very good. And I read the novel by Mick Herron, and I think that is just great. Talk about an imperfect character. If you look at the main character in Slow Horses, played by Gary Oldman, he's an alcoholic. He doesn't wash his clothes. He doesn't wash his hair. He shambles along. He's improper. He's absolutely oblique in his dealings with people, but he's great to watch. He's fantastic to watch. So I've really enjoyed Slow Horses for sure. I thought that was a very good one. I'm now watching the Jodie Foster series, which is True Detective Series 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. I think it's great acting and I think it's fabulous, but I don't know what's going on at this point. I'm a little bit lost. But it's strange. It's certainly gritty, and it's great to see Jodie Foster in a TV show and in a series. And she's playing a very tough woman in her 60s who's been kind of banished out to Alaska. But she certainly has an interesting life going, and I think that's fascinating. So those are the two things I've been watching right now.
Well, Ron, if our listeners are among the very few people left in South Africa who haven't read Flatwater Tuesday yet, we hope they will correct that soon. And also, we hope they will get hold of My Side of the Ocean. It is a magnificent book. It really is a good read. We hope everyone checks it out. It's available right now in bookstores and electronically. Thank you so much for your time, Ron. This has really been inspirational and informative, and it's been great. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. It feels like I've done a masterclass. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gail, you commented that you feel as though you've just sat through a masterclass on writing, and I have to say I feel the same way.
I don't think I've ever taken so many notes during one of our interviews. You know, I take notes of the things I find useful for myself later on, and I've got a page of notes here.
So tell us some of those notes. What have you taken from that?
Okay, I'm going to choose a few. I can't go through the whole page or we will be revisiting the whole podcast, but the things that I was particularly noted were, the first of all, he went back to a classic piece of writing advice about what does the character want.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you read that a lot and you forget it.
Yes.
And while he was talking, I was applying it to my work in progress. And what does that one want? What does that one want? Excellent advice, that. I also was very taken with what he said about rewriting from scratch, that he put the book aside, wrote the same book, but rewrote it from scratch. And I once did that by mistake, because my laptop was stolen.
Right, yes.
I have heard about writers who do it as part of their process, that they write, put it aside, write again. Who's got time for that, actually? But the fact of the matter is, when I did it, It worked. Mm-hmm. I wrote a much better book the second time. So if you are a person who is completely undriven by time and undriven by financial need and undriven by needing to finish, in other words, if you are very unlike me, I think it is a very good piece of advice. So I was interested in that. And then finally, I just loved the sentence that a novelist is a gossip because it made me feel okay about my entire personality. What about you, Fiona?
You know, it was something so useful that I got from it because it was an issue that I've been stuck on in this book that I'm trying to plot out and trying to create, which is that if you have a protagonist, especially one that is in any way based on yourself, you can't have this perfect protagonist, the victim that everything happens to. You've got to give your protagonist real, proper flaws. The shame and the hidden parts of your character are actually your friends as a novelist. You've got to bring them to the floor, bring them to the fore.
With the floor.
And make them the whole point. And I think if I can take this character and bring her real flaws out and make them the point, not the thing that you kind of hide away, I think that my book can finally get some direction here.
Maybe you can shorten that walk that you have to go on just a little bit, thanks to Ron. Fiona, do you have any advice of your own to give the listeners?
I do. And as usual, it's based on stuff we've discussed before, which is once you have your characters, give them something to do. Once you know what it is that your characters desperately want and are going for, give them things to do and construct it as a clear arc with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and have that at least the outline of it in mind before you start to write, because otherwise you're just going to find yourself in a swamp of, I don't know how I got here and I don't know how I'm going to get out of it. What about you, Gail?
I'm trying not to take that advice personally, given where I currently am. My thing that I want to talk about is a more, you like looking at the big picture, I'm looking at the little picture. Mm-hmm. And I just want to be clear, I haven't tried this or applied this to my own writing yet, but I heard it on a podcast. How often do I say that sentence? I heard it on a podcast and I was very interested in it. And this writer advised that if you want to write a book that is one of those gobble it up type books that moves very quickly, mm-hmm. you must focus on putting your verbs early in your sentence. Right. Whereas if you want to write a slower moving, more literary feeling book, put your verbs towards the end of your sentence. Mm-hmm. And now I am not a writer who carefully crafts my sentences as I go along, mm-hmm. but I'm very interested in this piece of advice. And I think it's something I'm going to look at when I edit.
Okay. I'm trying to imagine how this could look. And I'm thinking of something like the sentence, she burst into the room, which is very immediate, versus the sun rose in the east, the birds were tweeting, and a fine mist hung in the air as she burst into the room.
Yes.
I'm seeing it now. Yeah. It's becoming real in my mind.
Yeah.
That preamble is more literary. It slows the pace down. Yes. Versus the simple declarative, she burst into the room.
And maybe it's a sentence level use of the advice to start in the action. You know, you're advised to start a book if you want to write one of those gobble it up books, start in the action. And maybe we need to start our sentences in the action as well.
I like that because, to be honest with you, I do want to write a gobble it up book. And those are the books that I enjoy reading.
100%.
The ones that I can't wait to get back to.
100%.
So, speaking of Gobble It Up books, we want everyone to check out Ron Irwin's Flatwater Tuesday and My Side of the Ocean. You will be very pleased that you did. And if you have read these books, or if, like my son, you were prescribed Flatwater Tuesday at school and loved it, as my son did, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.